right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've got a really interesting show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network about a whole new campaign that the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has initiated aimed at making April 14th a day of no business as usual. It's going to be a shut it down, yell and holler in the streets day aimed at demanding an end to the police murder of black and brown people. So stay tuned for that. You're not going to want to miss it. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be doing this segment. You know, for quite some time, I've listened to people talk about how vaccinations are no good and all this other stuff. They cause more problems than they solve. I've been really sort of fascinated by this because I've always been an advocate of, now, well, I'll put it this way, bluntly, I think science is good, okay? And it's made a big difference in people's lives. And that's not ignoring the fact that there's also been problems in different areas and whatnot. But this thing of vaccinations and vaccines is something that is of historic importance and world importance for humans, for humanity. As I was thinking about this, and we were talking about this, my assistant producer came up with an idea that we should do something on vaccines and vaccinations and the controversy around that. And he found my next guest, and he is Dr. Paul Offit. And Dr. Offit is the Maurice R. Hilleman Professor of Vaccinology and a Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Offit is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, which has saved hundreds of lives throughout the world, and he's the author of scores of articles and several books. Dr. Offit, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Let's jump right into this. You know, there's been this huge sort of controversy, and some people dismiss it, you know, the controversy around vaccines and vaccinations and whether they do more harm than good. Some people dismiss it as sort of like, oh, well, it's a tempest in a teapot. But actually, it's a lot more important than that, I think. And I'd like to talk to you about what's your overall hit on this controversy around vaccinations?
Well, it's certainly not a scientific controversy. I mean, the notion, you could argue it's a cultural controversy that people became concerned, say, 15 years ago that, you know, the vaccines may cause autism based on this poorly done study, which was ultimately retracted in a British medical journal. And so the response was, you know, by academic folks and public health folks to kind of do studies to address that concern. And now you have roughly 14 studies that have shown that vaccines don't cause autism. So that's it's not controversial in a scientific sense. What's happened more recently is the controversy has changed even further. So no longer is the controversy surrounding issues of vaccine safety. Now it's sort of surrounding issues of, is it my right to catch and transmit a potentially fatal infection? That Disney outbreak was a tipping point. I've never seen parents so angry at other parents for putting not only their children at risk, but those with whom they come in contact at risk.
All right, we're going to get into that in just a little bit because that is a part of the interview that I wanted to dig into, a part of the whole subject that I wanted to dig into. But let's start with something else because I can't help but think that people have this sort of questioning, this fear of vaccinations, and I don't even know how broad that is, how widespread that is. But what comes out is people have a basic distrust for sort of medicine in a certain sense. And that's something that's cropped up a lot more in the sort of recent past. It's sort of been over the last 30 or 40 years where people begin to suspect all kinds of things are going on and we're getting treatments that we don't need. And you can speak to that, but I'd also like you to explain to people, wait a minute, just how do vaccines work? Why do we need vaccines? And where did this need come from?
Well, we need vaccines to save our lives. And if you look 100 years ago, we lived 30 years longer now than we did then, largely because of vaccines. I mean, vaccines would, you know, diphtheria would routinely kill teenagers. Polio would routinely paralyze, you know, young children and cause death in young children. Measles would cause 48,000 hospitalizations and 500 deaths a year. Rubella would cause these birth defects when it would affect pregnant women that were permanent and severe. So, I mean, we need vaccines because it makes us live longer lives and, frankly, better lives. The skepticism, I think it's actually not a bad thing at some level. My mother never questioned our doctor when he came over in the days of house calls. I mean, anything he said was fact, was truth. I mean, he was a god. I'm not sure that those days when doctors were sort of more pedantic, I think, and condescending and paternalistic, certainly, it was a good thing. So I think skepticism is good. I think you should be skeptical about anything you put in your body or, any test that's done on your body. What's the evidence that this is of value? I think that's fair enough. I think what happens is when you cross the line from skepticism to cynicism, that you just don't believe any of it. It doesn't matter what the data show. It doesn't matter what the scientific studies show. I know better because I have internet access.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't there an element too involved in that? I was just talking with my assistant producer again about this whole question and an element of populist epistemology ruling the day. That seemed to be something that comes up a lot in relation to science, where people ignore actually a scientific approach to reality, to understanding how reality runs and how you can work with it or change it and all of that. And what comes up instead is a populist epistemology, where what's right is determined by how many people think it's right.
That's right. It's kind of, I guess the term I would use is more of a kind of postmodernist way of thinking. It doesn't matter what your expertise is or what your experience is. My experience is as valid because I had it, and that's that. I mean, you know, Jenny McCarthy will go on the Oprah show, and Oprah will say, look, here's all these scientific studies that show this, and Jenny will say, well, I have my science, and his name is Evan, and he's at home. So it doesn't matter what studies are done. It is at least annoying. You know, science, you know, brought us out of the dark ages into the age of enlightenment. We shouldn't be so quick to give it up.
Yeah. Too many people are turning the lights out all over the place today. So let's look at some hard facts here, just some hard science. So again, let's talk about how vaccines work, and related to that, just how many vaccines are given to a child today?
I'll take your second part of your question first. So vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases are given in the first few years of life. There's another 2 diseases that are prevented in adolescence. So all told, it's really 16 different vaccines that are given in the first, you know, in childhood, children less than 18 years of age. The way that they work is that it's the best of both worlds. I mean, typically, if you get a measles infection and you survive it, you know, you'll be pretty much protected for the rest of your life. The problem is you might have to suffer the serious and occasionally fatal consequences of natural infection. Vaccines provide that immunity without having to make you suffer the consequences of natural infection. You know, we had, before there was a measles vaccine, there were 3 to 4 million cases of measles every year. 3 to 4 million cases every year. By 2000, we eliminated measles from this country. That tells you how powerful vaccines can be. And we eliminated with a vaccine that in no sense caused measles. So that's what vaccines do.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit is an American pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases and an expert on vaccines, immunology, and virology. Let's continue along this line. There are some times when I think, okay, say just for argument's sake, a number of people will argue that, yeah, that's true, but really, now that measles has actually been sort of eradicated in the U.S., is it really necessary to continue giving that vaccination?
Well, I think we've shown exactly why. So we pretty much eliminated in the U.S., which is to say that by the year 2000, there was no more spread of measles from one American child to another. But measles still came into this country. I mean, Philippines, for example, invariably suffer tens of thousands of cases every year, and usually between 30 and 60 people die every year in the Philippines from measles. And people fly from the Philippines into the United States. That's probably how the measles epidemic started in Disneyland. The difference between now, 2015, and 2000 was now there'd been enough of an erosion in herd immunity or community immunity so that the virus had the capacity to spread. I mean, you know, these public health agencies are working very hard to try and make sure there aren't secondary and tertiary cases. So we have 141 cases as of yesterday in 17 states because they have worked so hard to do that, quarantine people, give them immune serum globulin if they need to early after exposure. It's a lot of work to do that. Otherwise, I think that Disney outbreak would have been much, much worse. But, you know, why put these public health agencies through this when all you had to do was get a vaccine? Because most of these people who've gotten sick didn't get a vaccine. Mostly of them were children whose parents had made that choice stupidly. I mean, the fact of the matter is it's just a bad choice. And as a consequence, these children were put at unnecessary risk.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me something again. Wouldn't that also, though, open up the door to the idea that, look, vaccinations, I mean, people argue this stuff, too. They say too many vaccinations will overwhelm the immune system and can actually cause other problems in their own right.
Yeah, where's the evidence for that? Because certainly all the evidence is on the other side. You know, we know that, just biologically speaking, when you're in the womb, you're in a sterile environment. When you enter the birth canal in the world, you're not. And very quickly you have living on the surface of your body trillions of bacteria, I mean, literally trillions of bacteria to which you make an immune response. The number of immunological components in bacteria is logarithmically greater than anything you're ever going to get in a vaccine, you know, which is literally a drop in the ocean of what you encounter and manage every day. The food you eat isn't sterile. The dust you inhale isn't sterile. A common cold, frankly, infection is far more of an immunological challenge than anything you're going to get from all the vaccines we just talked about combined. So it's an easy appeal, right? You know, you get vaccines to prevent 14 different diseases. That can mean as many as 26 inoculations in the first few years of life. It can mean as many as 5 shots at one time. It's hard to watch that and not feel that your child is being overwhelmed by it, but they're not. Because when studies are done looking to see whether vaccines increase the risk of these chronic diseases that people are concerned about, autism, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, attention deficit disorder, study after study shows that they don't do that, nor does it make any biological sense that they would have.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that you mentioned earlier, just a couple minutes ago, you talked about herd immunity or community immunity. And I wanted you to explain what that was and why it's significant.
Right. So in order for viruses, for example, to spread through a community, there have to be a critical number of people who aren't immune. That you can get to a point where enough people are immune that the virus just simply can't spread. With the highly contagious viruses like measles or mumps or German measles, rubella or chickenpox or whooping cough for that matter, which is a bacteria, you know, you need a pretty high degree of protection for the very contagious diseases, really in the sort of low to mid 90% range. And when you start to see an erosion, that's when these diseases can spread, and that's what's happening. Now, remember, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people in the United States who can't be vaccinated. They depend on those around them to protect them. They can't be vaccinated because they're getting chemotherapy for their cancer, they're getting immune suppressive therapy for their chronic diseases. They depend on those around them because they're really, frankly, the most vulnerable.
Well, in that context, then, just another question related to that. Does that say, then, that this idea of the shunning of vaccinations or the idea of spreading vaccinations out, but really this idea that's becoming more and more popular, and by no means am I arguing for this. I'm just sort of posing the question. And as I'm posing it, I'm sort of thinking, oh, my God, what am I saying here? But, you know, the idea, I've heard people argue that we don't have to take vaccinations. We're not going to get infected. We're not going to do this. And if we do, we'll just get this. Our children will be able to take care of our children. And then they might even look at this question of herd immunity and community immunity and say, look, us, the smaller number of people who are not opting for vaccinations, actually are not going to cause a huge eruption in these diseases.
Until it did. So that's right. That was I think that's exactly the attitude. I mean, the people in Southern California, where some elementary schools in these upper middle class and upper class areas like Marina Del Rey or Beverly Hills or Santa Monica, said exactly that. Look, I'll hide in the herd. I mean, my children are healthy. I'm choosing not to get a vaccine, and you know, enough people are being vaccinated where I'll be okay. Until enough people weren't vaccinated, and then they weren't okay.
Now, another question here. You actually, even as you're arguing all this, you actually at one point, I think in 2002, you were the only member of the advisory board for the CDC, the Center for Disease Control.
Advisory Committee for Immunization Practice.
Right. You were the only member of that advisory board to vote against the program to give smallpox vaccinations to tens of thousands of people at a time when there was this big scare about smallpox was being sent through the mail and all this other stuff. You argued against it.
Yeah, I didn't think we needed to do it for a number of reasons. One, there had not been a small case of smallpox in this world since the late 1970s. Two, it's a vaccine that has a difficult safety profile, and that's a nice way to say it. I mean, it's still made, frankly, with all the technology that was available in the late 1700s. Three, it's a virus that will not hide. In other words, if you're coming in contact with someone with smallpox, you'll know it because there's no such thing as asymptomatic smallpox infection. They'll have, you know, these pox lesions on their face. And fourth, it's really only spread by large droplet, not small droplet. So you need to be really within 5 feet or face to face with the person who has smallpox in order to catch it. And most importantly, post-exposure prophylaxis works. And what I mean by that is that if you're exposed to someone who has smallpox, you really have a couple days to get a vaccine that can protect you. With all of that information, I thought we could have waited. I thought we could have just gotten people ready to vaccinate, make sure the vaccine was distributed just in case there was distribution of this virus by some rogue nation or group. But we didn't need to launch that program. And I think I still stand by that. I think I was right. I think I was right about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is related to this next question, which are there children, for instance, that should not get vaccinations because the risk would be too high for them?
Sure. I mean, children who have whose immune systems don't work well, either because of just they were born that way or because, you know, we've given them medicines like chemotherapy to make them that way. Those kids are obviously can't receive certainly the live weakened viral vaccines that are available. And then some kids are severely allergic to, say, a component in a vaccine like gelatin, which is contained in a couple of vaccines, that can cause allergic responses. Egg proteins, you know, in the flu or yellow fever vaccines can cause allergic reactions. I mean, they're treatable. Those allergic reactions are treatable, but, you know, those vaccines are not indicated for, you know, for children that have those problems.
There's a trend growing that says that, well, I'm not so much against vaccinations, but I don't want to overwhelm the immune system. I don't want to just pile on vaccinations. So two questions here. First, is there a danger in spreading the timing out of vaccinations, going against the what actually is the accepted schedule for vaccinating children? Now, is there a danger in just saying, I'm going to spread this out over a number of years instead of getting all the vaccinations at once?
Well, because vaccines don't in any sense overwhelm or perturb or weaken the immune system, a choice to spread them out does nothing to make them safer. All it does is increase the period of time during which you're susceptible to diseases that can hurt you or kill you. So there's no benefit to doing it. That may make you feel better, but it certainly doesn't benefit the child in any way.
Mm-hmm. And it actually could, in relation to this idea of getting to that point where actually the herd immunity is affected, that could actually contribute to that.
And even more importantly, it frankly contributes to needle phobia. I mean, some people will just never get more than, say, two shots at once. So they end up coming in again and again and again, more frequently than they would otherwise. And, you know, there have been studies done looking at, say, cortisol secretion, which is a sort of physiological measure of stress, to see whether you're more stressed when you get, say, two shots as compared to just one shot. And the answer is no. You're pretty much maximally stressed out at one shot. Plus, the older you get, the more likely you are to remember, frankly, the shot. So all it does is increase stress, increase needle phobia, doesn't decrease, you know, doesn't in any way make the vaccine safer. It just increases the period of time during which you're susceptible to diseases. It's silly.
Let's talk about your specific contribution. One of your contributions was you developed a vaccine for the rotavirus. What is that, and what's been the impact of this vaccine?
Right. So in the United States, rotavirus is a cause of fever and vomiting and diarrhea in children typically less than 2 years of age. Before the vaccine, every year in this country, there would be, about 75,000 or so children who were hospitalized with dehydration or water loss secondary to that virus infection. About 60 children would die, but millions of children would get it. I mean, pretty much no one gets to age 5 without having been infected by this virus. In the developing world, it's a killer. I mean, it kills about 2,000 children a day. Since the vaccine has come out in the United States and the uptake is about 80%, 85% of children get it, there's been a dramatic reduction in hospitalization. We used to see about 400 kids in our hospital a winter come into the hospital with dehydration secondary to this virus. Now we have fewer than 5. So the vaccine works, and now it's getting into the developing world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, where it has the capacity to save lives. So that, you know, that's something that was done by the team here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I think we're probably the thing professionally of which we're most proud.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit is an American pediatrician specializing in infectious diseases and an expert on vaccines, immunology, and virology. I think this will be the last question unless something pops up in the middle of this one. But, you know, it's really refreshing, one, to talk with you and to get this kind of outlook out there in a way that I think it really needs to be out there and fought for, much more so in the world today. But I also wanted to ask you this. You know, there's clearly, and you spoke to this earlier, there's just this sort of mind-numbing, dumbing down of the population in terms of in relation to this and many other things by what has arisen as this populist epistemology, this idea that I don't know much about science, but I know what I know, you know, and I can see it with my own eyes and I know what's going on. And there's this whole thing that's developed around this in terms of in relation to medical science in particular. And, you know, we've seen everything from the promotion of the idea that eating certain types of red leaf lettuce, for instance, can cure cancer, which is a very dangerous thing to be spreading around for people. But generally, that whole outlook seems to be really operating against the interests of humanity overall, and particularly in the world of science. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I wanted to specifically, you were involved in basically the fight, and you talked about it, the fight around do vaccinations actually lead to things like autism?
Yeah, I you're right. It's a, I think it's fair to ask the question, right? My child was fine. They got a vaccine. Now they're not fine. Could the vaccine have done it? The good news is it's a scientific question that can be answered in a scientific venue. And although a single study never answers a question, or frankly, argue proves a point, I think, you know, a collection of studies done by a variety of populations on several different continents, you can say that after a while, a truth emerges. And clearly a truth has emerged here. The part that's the most upsetting is that sort of intransigent group that says, I don't care what the data show. I know what I saw. My child was was fine, and then they got the vaccine, and then they weren't fine, because we're just incapable of distinguishing sort of causal from coincidental associations. I mean, the story I tell, because it's, I think, makes the point, my wife's a private practicing pediatrician. She goes into the office on a weekend. She's helping the nurse give vaccines. There's a four-month-old sitting on her mother's lap. While my wife is drawing the vaccine up into the syringe, the four-month-old has a seizure and goes on to have a permanent seizure disorder, epilepsy. In fact, did very poorly, just in the long run, did extremely poorly. Now, if my wife had given that vaccine 5 minutes earlier, I think there are no amount of statistical data in the world that would have convinced this mother of anything other than the vaccine caused it. What do you think? I'm stupid. My child comes in here, gets a shot, 5 minutes later has a seizure and now has a permanent seizure disorder. What else could it have been? So I think that's what you're up against. You're up against sort of emotional anecdotes that you're trying to fight with statistical analyses. And I think that's hard. It's not how we're wired. I think we're wired for emotion. Whereas our amygdala and hippocampus were far better developed than our cerebrum. Our cerebrum is late to the game.
Let me ask you one more question since you brought all that up. And my assistant producer is sitting here chuckling over that one. Seems to like it. Here's a question for you, because The other big argument that comes up is like, okay, you can give me all the science you want, you can give me everything else, but you know what? There's a thing like big pharma and the quest for profit. What's the impact of that? How would you speak to somebody about that?
Yeah, so I think a parent could reasonably ask, why should I trust an industry that is a for-profit industry? Why should I trust that? Well, the good news is you don't have to. First of all, before a vaccine can be put onto the market, you have to have studies in tens of thousands, sometimes more than hundreds of thousands of children, to show that your vaccine is exactly what it's claimed to be, one. Two is that those data are then reviewed not only by the FDA, which then licenses the product, but reviews by groups like the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Association of Family Practitioners, which then say, okay, these data are good enough to allow it to be recommended. And then thirdly, and probably most importantly, once a vaccine rolls out, there are systems in place like the Vaccine Safety Data Link and the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, which very quickly can pick up whether or not a vaccine caused a problem. So nobody's going to hide. If the pharmaceutical companies in any way misrepresented data, you'll very quickly know whether or not there was a problem. You don't have to trust them.
All right, one more. What do you see now as the critical front in terms of the battle around vaccinations?
I think the issue now, the issue of the day, is this balance between individual rights and societal good. I mean, should it be my right to allow my child to catch and potentially transmit a potentially fatal infection? I think that's why the Disney outbreak was such a tipping point. People were really angry. Last year we had 650 cases of measles, and 380 of them occurred in an Amish community in Medina County, Ohio. That, and the media pretty much ignored it. I think people ignored it, maybe because we saw it as other, it's Amish, it's an insular group, it's not us. But Disney's different. Disney's a shared space. It's a commons. And in addition to being the happiest place on earth, I think, it's that place you go to get away from the burdens of the real world, which now we've sort of, it's like an Eden. It's like a Garden of Eden, a utopia that we've now fouled with this potentially fatal virus. It's almost biblical.
And remember, never get the mouse angry. Okay. All right, Dr. Offit, thank you very much for a very enlightening and actually uplifting interview around this. And we'll have to have you back in the near future.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Sure. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about police brutality, police murder of black and brown people, and the fight to stand up against it and stop it. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Sound the Alarm from the Thievery Corporation. Okay, in this next segment, we're going to concentrate on police murder and the struggle to stop it. And I thought I'd open the segment up with a little bit of a segment from a speech that Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, made back in the early 2000s. And this speech is part of an overall talk called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. So check this out.
Think about what happened to Amadou Diallo in New York. Now, Richard Pryor used to have this routine he did to show what it was like for a black man just in an ordinary encounter with the police. How you had to try to avoid being one of those mistakes where you got killed. He talked about a black man gets pulled over by the police and he has to say, "I am reaching into my pocket for my license because I don't want to be no motherfucking accident." You have to show them and make clear and loud that you're going into your pocket to bring out your wallet. Otherwise, they'll say you had a gun and shoot you down. And for Amadou Diallo, even that didn't work. Amadou Diallo pulled out his wallet and held it up, and they shot him down anyway. 41 times they shot at him. They pumped his body with bullets. Or look what happened around here to Taisha Miller. The police came up on her. She was in a car, apparently passed out. Her family came up. They begged the police because the car was locked, let them find a way to open it. But no, the police couldn't wait. They fired into the car 29 times, shooting her in the back 12 times. And that wasn't the worst of it. When the family came and was grieving, the cops started mocking them with racist taunts. "Oh, what is this, Kwanzaa? What is this, the Watts Wail?" This is America. This is the greatest of all countries. Well, what about what happened with Donovan Jackson and how the cops got off on that thing, too? They took him, they punched him in the face and slammed his head down on a car for no good reason and no reason at all. But they got off. One of them got acquitted completely and the other one, oh, you know, the jury couldn't decide. But let's not blame the jury as much as the judge and the prosecutor. Whenever they're forced to put a cop on trial for brutality or murder, all of a sudden the prosecutors forget how to prosecute. Anybody who has a case, I'm sure they say, "God damn, give me that prosecutor when I got my case go up." They don't call witnesses. They don't ask the witnesses the right questions. They accept the defense theory of what happened and then argue little nitpicky things about it within that framework. The same thing happened with the Amadou Diallo case. The jury found him not guilty, and one of the jurors afterwards said, "I wish we could have found him guilty. I hope they sue him, those cops, and get all kinds of money out of him. But the way the judge set it up, we had to go by the law, so we couldn't find him guilty." Well, they should have found him guilty anyway, but you know what she's saying. And the judge is part of it, too. It's part of the conspiracy. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off. Look what happened in the Rampart scandal, a scandal in L.A. They shot up this dude, Latino brother. Then they accused him of assaulting the police. He comes in the court in a wheelchair. He's convicted. The judge gives him almost a maximum sentence. Why? Because he didn't show remorse. For what? He didn't do any goddamn thing. But this is the way it works. And what happened when they finally had to put these Rampart cops, or a couple of them, on trial? The judge did everything she could to get the jury not to find him guilty. But this time, the jury found him guilty anyway, so the judge threw out the verdict. Yes, there's a conspiracy to get the cops off.
All right, once again, that was a segment of a speech from Bob Avakian called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can find that speech in its entirety at revolutiontalk.net. And now I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show my next guest. His name is Carl Dix. People are familiar with him. He's been a frequent guest on our show, and he's a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Carl, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away because there's so much to talk about in so little time. The Stop Mass Incarceration Network was recently involved in a conference that was held on February 7th and 8th. What was the conference about? Who was there and what did it do in broad general terms?
Okay, the conference in Atlanta the weekend of February 7th and 8th, was called by the Stop Mass Incarceration Network to go over a proposal for retaking the offensive in the movement to stop police getting away with murder in this society. And who came to it was more than 170 people from about 12 different cities. There were students, there were people from the faith community, there were parents of police murder victims, relatives of incarcerated people, attorneys, teachers, activists from a number of different backgrounds. About half, a little bit more than half of the people were Black, but there was a real diversity there, you know, whites, Latinos, Asians. And what brought us together was, one, the power and the beauty of the outpourings of resistance last year to the horror of police murdering Black people and Latino people again and again and again, and being let go by the criminal injustice system. The power and the beauty of those protests, but also an awareness that the authorities were trying to suppress those protests through a combination of threats, mass arrest, but also trying to change the narrative from one of police murdering unarmed and innocent people and getting away with it to one of police being unfairly criticized as they were doing a tough job very well. And we could see that that was an attempt to continue the normal routine of this country, a normal routine that has built within it police as frontline enforcers who got a green light to brutalize and even kill people in order to keep this setup in effect, keep the oppression and exploitation of Black people and Latino people in effect. So we felt we had to come together and forge a plan for retaking that offensive, and that plan centers around April 14th, Tuesday, April 14th, as a nationwide day of disrupting business as usual. No school, no work. People from colleges, high schools, communities coming together and saying no more to police getting away with murder.
Well, let me ask you this. You've said in other places and things that I've read about the conference, talked about the movement confronting a huge need and a great opportunity. How does that relate to the conference and the movement at a crossroads?
Well, it's pretty much the point to the conference. And the need is concentrated in, are they going to get away with suppressing the people who've been standing up and saying the horror of police having a green light to brutalize and even murder Black and Latino people is going to continue being the normal routine. Are they going to get away with suppressing that protest? Are they going to get away with the threats, the arrests, but also the trying to get people to go back within the confines of the system, come up with some reform proposals that the system will review, mostly not implement, but are they going to take the movement off of the streets and, frankly, to the cleaners? That's the necessary part. We need to not knuckle under to that, to not go back to business as usual and accepting these horrors in silence. But the opportunity is that if we are successful in retaking the initiative, in taking the movement of resistance back out into the streets in a very powerful way and drawing new people into it, then we can tear things apart even more. One of the people at the conference, Oscar Grant's uncle, said that the protests last year had hemorrhaged this society, and people were beginning to see the ugly reality of police getting away with murder, and that it needs to be hemorrhaged even more so that more and more people can see that ugly reality and feel challenged to join it And that's what we got to do. We got to tear this society even farther open, farther apart around this question. Make it so that people who are generally shielded from it and don't know that this happens in the inner cities in this country and the ghetto and barrios are more exposed to it, have to confront it, and challenged to stand on the right side of it. Because right is on the side of the people who stood up, but they're trying to snatch that away from people and come forward with a narrative that switches right back onto the side of the police who brutalize and murder and the legal system that lets them off when they do.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Carl Dix. Carl is from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about a recent conference in Atlanta that was organized around pushing forward in the movement against police murder, police brutality, and the whole genocidal assault against black people and the murder of black and brown people across this country. Carl, let me ask you this. You know, we're talking about that crossroads and the conference contributing to get past that. Did people come with that in mind? Did they come with the idea of wrestling with that? And how did was there a lot of discussion around that? How did that fall out?
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion around it. I mean, a draft call for the April 14th day of disrupting business as usual had gone out in advance of the conference. The assessment of the crossroads was put forward to people, and people came to the conference and wrestled very seriously with it. Are we at a crossroads? If so, what do we do about it? Is this the approach to take? Is there some other approach? And generally speaking, the people who came were coming because they felt that what had been done last year in terms of the powerful outpourings of protest was very important and very necessary, because without it, a lot of those killings would have just been shoved under the rug. But also concern because the level of resistance had been settling, trying to figure out, well, how do we get it back going? What should it look like? And what about this call? Is this what we should do? Is this how we should frame it? Is this the approach we should take? And, you know, we spent 2 days grappling with that. We heard from, you know, religious leaders. We heard from a number of parents of police murder victims who testified to the pain and anguish of losing a loved one, but also the way in which they drew strength when people stood with them to fight against this injustice, and how necessary this is if we're going to continue to bring out and bring to bear the reality of this injustice and challenge many more people to get with it. So there was a sense that we had to do something, and let's just figure out what it was. And through the course of our 2 days of deliberations, we decided April 14th, day of disrupting business as usual all across the country, was the way to go. We finalized a call, began to hammer out a plan to build up to it, and now we're working to get on a mission to spread this everywhere in society.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to get into it a little bit more towards the back end of this interview, but I wanted to pursue a couple other questions first.
Okay.
And one was, you know, part of, I want to know if this was also part of what, you know, and I think it is. I think you were saying this, that it was part of the need, the great necessity that you faced, as well as the great opportunity. But part of that great need is that there had been, particularly since since the end of December, there had been, a concerted effort by the ruling class by the system, to actually stand up and hit back at this in many, many different ways. There's the campaign of lies that was aimed at killing the movement. There was the kind of increased oppression of activists and other people in New York City that's coming down. All these things seem to be aimed at really squashing the movement or putting it down in it, you know, in its bed, either that or sending it off in another direction.
Yeah, that was an important part of it. And, you know, look, especially when the two cops were killed in Brooklyn, this went into high gear. I mean, because they came out with calls for a moratorium on protests.
You might have to explain who those two cops were.
The two cops, I think it was December 20th, two cops were on regular patrol duty, And the story from the authorities is that an individual who had come up to New York from Maryland that morning went up to these two cops and shot them and killed them and then killed himself. From the moment that happened, what began to be thrown out was, well, the death of these two cops was a result of the protest activity because they had been, you know, the protests had created a poisonous atmosphere directed at the cops. People were asked and called on to stop protesting, at least until the cops were buried. Additionally, they started raising, well, this shows the protests had gone too far and that people needed to back off of it because, after all, the cops have a very tough job and they're doing it well, and it's really beyond the pale to be criticizing them like this. And in the face of that, remember, we had called for a protest on New Year's Eve prior to the killing of these cops. And when we did our press conference, you know, to talk about that, what the media threw back at us is, are you going to respect the moratorium that the mayor had called for, the police unions were calling for it, the governor was calling for it? And we had to say, look, police have continued to murder people. The system has continued to give them a pass. And as long as that's still happening, then we cannot back off of our protest. And on top of that, those who preside over a system that gives a green light to brutal murdering cops have got no right to tell people how to protest that horror, when to protest it, whether they could protest it or not. But that has had an impact, as well as the large numbers of arrests, people being hit with very heavy charges for the crime of protesting. All of this is having its impact on people. I guess a couple of people got involved in a little bit of pushing and shoving on the Brooklyn Bridge during one protest, and then the cops started putting people's pictures, releasing it to the media, and people's pictures would be on the front page of the tabloid with the captions calling on the public to help the police find these people for the crime of brushing up against cops or getting into a little bit of pushing and shoving with them during a demonstration. So here you have a system that has some cops video choking Eric Garner to death and can find no crime involved in that. But people who might have brushed up against the cop have their pictures plastered on the tabloids with the public being called on to help the police find these desperate criminals. So you see the narrative being turned on top on its head, you know, where the people who are protesting, who are right, are the ones who are being criminalized and demonized. And cops who commit murder and brutality are being given a pass.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party. Go ahead, Carl. You can continue on.
So this is some of what we're up against, and it's very important that people not knuckle under and go back in the face of it, because it won't even be that things will be back where they were before. Because part of the impact of these protests is that it really changed the way that people look at police murder in terms of people who live their lives in the inner cities dealing with brutal cops who brutalize and even murder people. Their eyes lit up when they saw people standing up to say this needs to stop. And it gave them a sense that maybe they don't have to continue suffering this anymore.
Well, you
people
know,
who didn't know it was happening had their eyes open to it and were challenged to join in. And if they get away with suppressing this, then it'll send a message to all of those people and beyond. There's nothing you can do about it. So it'll be even worse than before, because people will feel like, well, we tried to do something and it didn't work. So I guess we just have to put up with this.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that actually, it's interesting because I was looking at, again, something I'd read a little while ago, but the head of the FBI, he made a statement about how the problem was that the relationship between the people and the police has been broken. It has been sort of, we need to get that relationship back to on its right, you know, on the right side, on the right way of doing things. And it's sort of saying that the people need to have more of a connection, a better connection with the police than they do now. And it sort of fits in with what you're saying about the changes that were wrought by the months of actually people being in the streets to fight against this police terror.
Yeah, I mean, and see, look, we don't need better relations between the police and the community because the police are not out there protecting and serving the community. They're not out there to keep the people safe. What they're out there to do is to keep in effect the system of exploitation and oppression that rules over the people. And that's why cops who brutalize and murder get away with it, because that brutality and even murder is targeted towards suppressing people that this capitalist imperialist system hates and fears. And we don't need to have a good relationship with our brutalizers and our murderers. We actually need revolution to get rid of the system that has these cops out there and backs them up when they carry out their murderous deeds against the people. That's what's necessary around this. And mounting the kind of resistance that we're talking about doing around April 14th has everything to do with preparing the people, preparing the ground, getting ready and in position for the kind of revolution that can sweep this system away and bring a whole different way of life into being for people, and one where those who would be entrusted with public security, because that's what, in theory, the role of the police is supposed to be, would sooner lose their own lives than kill or injure an innocent person. That's the kind of society we should live in. But in this society, it's the other way around. When the cops brutalize somebody, when the cops murder somebody, they will openly say, well, we have to give the cops the benefit of the doubt. Why does a trained law enforcement officer get the benefit of the doubt over a child? Because a number of the victims, I just came yesterday from a vigil around the police murder of Tamir Rice and other children. Why does a cop, a trained, so-called trained law enforcement person, get the benefit of the doubt when they encounter and kill a 12-year-old boy who's got a toy gun?
You know, it's interesting, too. It's very heavy because the thing is that it does really hide, this kind of twisting of the relationships between the police and the people does really hide what's actually going on historically in this country as well, all the way back to the lynchings, all the way through, you know, the Jim Crow era, all this stuff that's actually piled up, and including, I just recently read something, I think it was on revcom.us, where they talked about the number of police killings just in 2013 was somewhere around, what was it, 460 or something in that year alone? And you think about what the reality of life for black and other oppressed people is in this society, in this country, and that's actually what the police are enforcing. It's a whole other story.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you talked about those numbers. A study has been done, I forget the name of the grouping, but they have documented more than 100 people killed by police so far this year. Mm. More than 100 in less than 2 months. And that is the reality of what happens with the police. And when you look into these cases, most of the people are young. More than half of them were not armed when they lost their lives and were not involved in criminal activity. Yet, overwhelmingly, these killer cops, you know, face no punishment whatsoever. That is wrong. It is horrific. It is illegitimate, and it needs to be stopped. And look, I'll tell you, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to stop it once and for all. And we in the Revolutionary Communist Party are building a movement for revolution that is aimed at getting ready in position for that needed revolutionary thrust to get rid of this horror and all the other horrors that people face, whether that's the attacks on women, the devastation of the environment, government spying, the wars for empire. And look, wherever you stand on that question, whether you think revolution is what's needed or whether you don't know about it or what, you have to see the basic illegitimacy of police getting a green light to brutalize and murder people, and you need to stand up and join the resistance to it. And people need to check this out and enlist in it, and I'm going to give two websites to check into to do that. One is to go to the Stop Mass Incarceration website, that's stopmassincarceration.net, for the call for April 14th, the plans for building up to it. Also go to the website revcom.us. There's a lot of coverage of the Atlanta conference there, a couple of articles from me around this question, as well as other questions that are dealt with. And the vision of the kind of world and society that could be brought into being through revolution and how that would transform people's lives.
All right, Carl, so let me do this one more time. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix, who's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we're talking about a huge, huge day of protests, shutting it down, actually, you know, a day of no business as usual, all across the country on April 14th. Now, Carl, let's back up, and just for the last 5 minutes or so, let's talk about, okay, April 14th, what exactly is it? What are the demands?
Well, what it is it's going to be a day of disrupting business as usual all across the country. No school, no work. Students from colleges, high schools, walking out, acting on campus, taking over buildings, people in communities gathering, marching in protest, and shutting it down. The hashtag for it is ShutdownA14. That's the hashtag, and that's what it's going to be about. And our demands are very basic and simple. Our demands are not like tinkering with the system that is oppressing and brutalizing people. Here's what it comes down to. The murder of black and brown people by the police must stop. Justice for all the victims of brutal murdering police. Indict, convict, and send killer cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell. And stop the repression targeting the protest. Drop all the charges against all those arrested.
Now let me ask you this. You also talked about, and something I read recently, you were talking about that there were two concentrations that you're going to be focusing in on in terms of this effort to build April 14th. There's two concentrations, two pathways that you see as being really critical to reaching the people you want to reach and to be able to mobilize this in a way that it needs to be mobilized. And I think one was students and the other was people who have been in the streets already.
Yeah, we want to reach out to campuses, and are beginning to reach out to campuses all across the country with the call for April 14th, with plans to begin acting right now. We took up the nationwide call for justice for Tamir Rice and the other children who have been victims of police murder. That was February 22nd. We are taking the message of April 14th to the 50th anniversary of the march across the Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. There's going to be a nationwide day of blowing the whistle against brutal murdering cops on March 14th. And we want students to be heavily involved in all of that. We also are reaching out to everybody who's been in the streets, all the organizations that have been out there, all the individuals that have been out there with this message of we can't go back. We can't let them get away with suppressing our protests. We have to retake the initiative and bring forward even more powerful waves of resistance to the horror of the green light that this society gives to police who brutalize and kill. And that would be very crucial to delivering this message that this horror must stop. And that's the message that's got to be delivered and it's got to be continually delivering it. But April 14th is going to be a very important nodal point in terms of bringing that movement not only back out, but back out on a higher level.
Mm-hmm. All right, Carl, and one more time, let people know, if they want to get involved in this, what do they do?
Go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. Get the call for April 14th. You can download it, begin to spread it. You can spread it online. You can print it out. There's files to print out. Let everybody know about it. Call on people to enlist in it. Call on them to donate generously to help make it happen. All of that can be done through the website, stopmassincarceration.net. And also go to the website, revcom.us, because there's a vision there of the kind of world that we could bring into being through revolution and ways to act on that right now, including through taking up the mobilization for April 14th. Shut down A14. Police murder must stop.
All right, Carl Dix, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we've been talking about April 14th, a day of no business as usual, stop police terror and police murder of black and brown people. And that just about brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Paul Offit and Carl Dix, and I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Federico Garcia, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with one of my favorite songs this year, and it's by Chucky Weiss. It's called Bomb the Tracks, and it poses a moral question for each and every one of us. Check this out.
Burnus took us on a Volkswagen.